This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Governor Deval Patrick wants to take control of the state's probation department after an independent investigation found systemic corruption there. According to that investigation, state legislators use the department as a de facto employment agency for their friends and political donors. The investigative report by Boston lawyer Paul Ware recommends that many of the probation department's top managers be fired and that law enforcement officials bring criminal charges. Paul Ware spoke with WBUR this morning about the abusive hiring practices.
It became so pervasive that good people within the department were demoralized, sometimes didn't apply. If they did apply, they weren't appointed, and individuals far less qualified got jobs. In some cases, hopelessly unqualified people.
Corruption in the probation department is just one of the stories we'll be talking about today with our Week in Review panel. Our panelists this week are Peter Kanellis, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Peter.
Thank you, Sasha.
And Kurt Nickisch, WBUR's business and technology reporter. Hi, Kurt.
It's a pleasure.
And listeners, we're taking calls. We want to know what you want to talk about in the news this week. What story caught your attention? We wonder if you're surprised by the extent of corruption in the probation department, or if this really isn't surprising to you at all. We want to know if you think the state should fork over $25 million in tax breaks to keep 140 jobs at GE. That's not make jobs, but keep jobs. We want to talk possibly about the filing's basement site permit being revoked and anything else you want to talk about. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment online at wbur.org/Boston. Peter Kanellis of the Boston Globe, let's talk first about the probation department story, because this was really a story spurred by the Boston Globe. This was a Globe Spotlight Team story back in the spring. I remember those stories. It was this almost itemization of who was hired for what sort of bogus reason and by whom. And, you know, many of those stories, Peter, focused on the department's commissioner, John O'Brien, who was suspended after those stories ran. But obviously, the issue shows that this corruption goes much further than one individual. Is that what, part of what you took away from this report this week?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is quite a disgusting situation, and it suggests that most of the legislature, if not the entire legislature, knew that the system had been created to get jobs for their friends and really did nothing about it for a long period of time. And it raises very serious questions about the ethics and the underlying assumptions of the people who run the legislature.
Well, and Brian McGrory, the Globe columnist this morning, you know, he talked about this corruption, and he said that, you know, he points out that even the current Speaker of the House, Robert DeLeo, got his godson a job at the department. So in your sense, Peter Kanellis, is this about to turn into a big problem for lawmakers on Beacon Hill?
Absolutely, and it should be. And not only could it be a problem, but there could be criminal charges brought against some of the most active politicians, and there certainly should be. And it's quite pervasive. I'm not saying that everything involved in it is criminal, but the pervasiveness is what you take away from this report.
Kurt Nickisch, do you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I think the statement that we saw from House Speaker Robert DeLeo that, you know, he's sort of dismayed by what's in this and he's going to look into it, it's a little lacking. I mean, he clearly is not the central person in this, but to have been in the House and then become House Speaker and really not know about it can't reflect well on him, but it also can't reflect well to have known about it. So I think that's kind of disappointing to a lot of people.
Peter Kanellis, you referenced criminal charges, and of course that's one of the things that the independent investigator, Paul Ware, who's a Boston lawyer at Goodwin Procter, is calling for. Do you think that is inevitably the next step, that criminal charges will come?
Yes, I do. The only question there will be to against how many people and in what capacities they were working.
You know, one of the things that Governor Patrick has been calling for is that this department should be an executive department. And I wonder, Peter Kanellis, if you think that is the solution, or does that just move patronage problems over to the governor's office?
Well, no, I think it's a better system. I mean, people, listeners should understand that this is a system that was created largely by former House Speaker Tom Finneran back in 2001. And under the guise, it's really a very troubling thing. Under the guise of taking it away from political control, they put it under one person who was sort of commissioner for life, John O'Brien, and he then catered to all of these different representatives who were sending over patronage employees to work in this department. And it shows bad faith at just so many levels and in so many different places. So clearly this was a corrupt system that was probably intended to be corrupt right from the start. So moving it into the governor's office will be a very, very different story. You'll have somebody who's an elected official who would be directly responsible for it. If any governor were caught or found to be overseeing a patronage network this vast, it would absolutely kill them politically. And so I think that would be a big improvement. Now, there's also a proposal to put it under the control of the legislature, which is where it had been. The judiciary, which was where it had been before. And that should be considered as well. And obviously, Scott Harshbarger, the former attorney general, is going to be looking into all of these questions.
Kurt Nikisch?
I think you can look at a lot of other states that where it seems like oversight by the justice system, by the judicial branch, has been. You know, many experts consider that sort of the most effective system because you do have this patronage problem kind of wherever it can go. And the other important thing to remember about this is that we're talking about probation. We're talking about this system that's supposed to save taxpayers' money by not having people in jail, by giving them a chance at rehabilitation. So the failure of this whole system to be able to execute well has an immense social cost.
Peter, you talked about the vastness of this patronage system that's been uncovered at probation. I wonder, though, whether if the Spotlight team, for example, were to sort of look individually at most state departments, would we find something similar?
I think that you would find, well, I don't know about most departments. I'm sure that there are other pockets of patronage in state government. But this seems to have been an agency that was set aside, again, by Finneran and O'Brien back in 2001 to be essentially a patronage dumping ground. And there probably are others, but I would resist a little bit making a broad assumption that every agency is like this.
Listeners, we're talking about the news of the week. We want to know what news you want to talk about or you want to weigh in on. We've been talking about the patronage story going on at the probation department. We'll be talking about General Electric telling Massachusetts it needs $25 million in tax breaks if it's going to be able to keep about 140 jobs. And then there's stories going on with Filene's basement. Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I mean the former Filene's building that's now a hole in the ground in Downtown Crossing. Let's talk about that GE threat, let's call it. This was a case where General Electric is saying it may have to lay off more employees at its plant in Lynn. I think it's already had to lay off quite a number of them. Unless the state of Massachusetts can come up with $25 million in tax breaks. So that's $25 million for about 140 jobs, which I think somebody calculated comes out to about $500,000 a job. Peter Kanellis, can you tell me your general thoughts about this?
In general, I think there are a lot of reasons for the governor and his economic development secretary to be very skeptical of this. One is that on the grounds of retaining jobs, any manufacturing outfit can come forward and say, we might have to lay off people if we don't get a special tax credit. And I don't know how, if they grant this to the GE plant, they're going to be able to separate that out from all these other requests that are likely to come down the pike. So setting a bad precedent is one potential problem. Another one is you can't really measure how many jobs are saved because we don't know what GE's plans are right now. They're essentially saying they're going to have laid off already all of the people that they planned on laying off, but they will guarantee for 6 years that they'll keep 3,000 workers there if they get this tax credit. But we don't know whether they were planning on laying anyone else off at all. So they may just get the money and preserve jobs that they were always planning on preserving. So it's a very tough application to assess.
Kurt Nikisch, you cover business for BUR, obviously, and you've covered many of the tax breaks that companies get to come here. They're sort of wooed here by this. What are your thoughts about this GE story this week?
Well, it's kind of interesting because their problem is a lot like Obama's problem was explaining the stimulus, that a job saved was equal to a job created. It's a tough argument practically, though, to make, even though business-wise, you know, there may be economic reasons for it. But a lot of companies, you know, for instance, may promise to create new jobs for something they were going to do anyway, and the tax credits or tax breaks are a bonus. So, you know, one aviation industry analyst we talked to this week said, you know, he just would have done the same thing himself. and GE is very profitable. This aviation business unit is very profitable. But they also see that Pratt & Whitney over in Connecticut is getting some tax breaks, too. And you know, it's just their chance to try to make the most of the situation.
Let's go briefly back to the probation story, because we have a caller that wants to weigh in on this. And this is Kevin from Rosendale. And so, Kevin, what has your reaction been to finding out the scale of the nepotism problem at the state probation department?
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask, I've noticed the private sector and the public sector that I've been told year after year, it's not what you know, but who you know. And I think it's becoming even more widespread because of the lack of jobs. People are, you know, helping out who they know, and it's not really helping, you know, people and trying to get jobs.
Kevin, you think you think a poor economy contributes to this?
A poor economy and a lack of keeping, you know, this type of thing in check. You know, it kind of happens. You know, so people don't really see it going on as much, and there's not really, you know, big crackdown on it. So that's why I feel like the probation department, you know, gotten to a point where, you know, it's gone too far and someone noticed it. But
Kevin, thanks for that. I want to bring in another caller. This is Paul from Belmont. And Paul, what's your thought about this probation department story?
I want to know whether your panel believes that Speaker DeLeo and the rest of the leadership team are in any danger of getting voted out of their leadership positions. Is there any chance that the backbenchers would throw them out on this scandal?
Paul, thanks for that. Peter Kanellis of The Globe, do you want to weigh in on that?
I think it's too early to tell, but I do think that DeLeo minimized this issue early on when the Spotlight team was first working on it and has a lot to answer for now. And certainly we as an editorial board won't let him off the hook, and he has to answer those questions, and we'll have to see what develops.
Let me bring in one more caller, and this is somebody from Newburyport. And Bob, what is your thought about the probation story?
My thought is just that, where is the Chief Justice of Administration in all of this? Supposedly in the report, it says that, you know, he may have known about these practices before, and he did nothing to fix them over his tenure. And it seems like, you know, the report is protecting him but punishing other people. Well, shouldn't the buck stop with him? He's the boss.
Peter Kanellis, do you want to weigh in on that one?
Are you referring to the people who were running it prior to 2001, when it was under the judiciary?
I'm talking about the Chief Justice of Administration.
The current person.
I see. Who overlooked O'Brien? I think O'Brien was not fireable, unless I'm misreading the situation. And so, you know, as far as I know, I think the buck stops with O'Brien and with Finneran and with the legislators who were involved.
Let's move on to a different story. This is one related to commercial real estate, which has been primarily in the business section, and at first may not seem like that local of a story, but it actually has an interesting local connection. It has to do with the financial crisis in Ireland having effects over here in Boston. The Irish government has taken over the Anglo-Irish Bank and is trying to get money out of the bank's former CEO, who, as it turns out, now lives here in Massachusetts. Richard Downs is the Washington, D.C. correspondent for Ireland Radio and Television, and he says former CEO David Drum is not well-liked by his countrymen.
They're having a really tough time, and then they look at this guy, David Drum, and they say, hey, hang on a sec, he seems to have two big houses in a swanky part of Boston. How come he's doing so well and we're doing so badly?
So Kurt Nickish of BUR, first tell us, where are those two swanky houses in Boston that he's talking about?
Well, Boston to Richard Downs, it really means Chatham and Wellesley. and it's funny because Drum was kind of this young, very very impressive banker who worked for the bank, and he actually came over and opened the Boston office. So it's not, you know, by chance that he's landed here. He ended up really sort of aggressively pushing commercial loans in Boston real estate. And when I say aggressive, they were, you know, good loans, but he was sort of on the scale of being more aggressive rather than moderate, but not, you know, not irresponsible. And he went, you know, made a name for himself, went back, became CEO of Anglo-Irish Bank, and then the bank went downhill. The government took it over. He retired and moved back here.
And tell us why the bank is in the news this week. A very recognizable address is in the news this week because of this bank.
Yeah, 1 Kendall Square is one of these properties that got a loan a few years back from Anglo-Irish Bank. Anglo is involved in a whole bunch of places that you probably recognize. They used to have Westwood Station, properties on Franklin Street and State Street and School Street downtown. But One Kendall Square is one that it's not really clear what's going on there, other than the fact that Anglo stopped doing loans here in Boston a few years ago when they went into trouble. So unlike housing, in the housing market where you have like a 30-year loan, it's very typical in commercial real estate to have a 5- or 10-year loan, and then you re-up. And basically, Anglo-Irish Bank doesn't have money. They need to get money back, and they're just not re-upping, asking for capital back. And so places like One Kendall Square, or other places like that that have Anglo-Irish, they have to find new lenders.
So is it like being foreclosed on for a commercial property? Is that the equivalent? Are we just talking about they're now suddenly – what is the threat to them?
So they would be if they couldn't find new lenders. And that's what happened here in Boston in the 1990s is, you know, Bank of New England wouldn't renew a commercial loan to a place because they didn't have the money. But then those properties couldn't find new lenders, and unless they could come up with a difference, they got foreclosed on. Fortunately, in this environment, there are a lot of lenders willing to lend for existing commercial properties. And One Kendall Square, as you know, is pretty successful, has good rents, very popular place, you know, still very active. So I don't think that place is in danger of foreclosure, and I don't think a lot of places in Boston are. But those developers have to find new places. The only caveat I'd say is that any sort of undeveloped properties like land that Anglo-Irish financed, that could be a problem.
And Peter Canellis, is this something you want to weigh in on at all?
I think it's an interesting case because the Irish government, I guess, has taken over this bank and has put all this property in Boston in jeopardy. And it's one of those things where we just have to wait and see how significant the ramifications are, but they could be quite significant.
Let's also talk about a different commercial property issue, but one that most people will know about because of that giant hole in the ground in Downtown Crossing. It's the former Filene site. It finally had its permits yanked by the city this week. And tell us, Kurt Nickisch, your sense of what's the significance of the Boston Redevelopment Authority's move to yank that permit?
Well, they're upping the ante. They basically want Vornado Realty Trust out of there and would like to get that place developed. It is, as I just said, very difficult market for any new commercial construction. And so that's not to say that if someone else came along that it would really be successful either. But that's they're basically just trying to kick these folks out.
Peter Canellis, do you think that makes it more likely that hole in the ground stays a hole in the ground longer, or will this speed up the process of getting something built there?
I think it'll speed up the process of getting something built there, but I don't know how quick that process is going to be in any case. I think that Vornado was clearly waiting until the market turned around and until they got more favorable terms, and you know, this creates a possibility that other people can come in with proposals. So I do think it's a positive step, but I wouldn't expect something to get built very quickly.
Before we go, let's do what we always call our Friday hubbub. This is where I want all of us to weigh in on one story that caught our attention this week that may not have gotten a lot of attention. And Kurt, what's yours?
Well, it's so funny because yesterday I was down at Downtown Crossings after dark. The weather, you know, got cold last night, so you could see your breath. The city has already started putting up Christmas decorations along Washington Street. And I was walking along, and there was just this beautiful light over the place. And I looked up, and it was the moon shining down over that hole where Filene's basement used to be, right there at Downtown Crossing. And it was just beautiful. It was one of those moments, you know, that I know we all have where we just are so grateful to live in a beautiful city like Boston. And ironically, it was because that building was
the
gone.
The building isn't there. And Peter Canellis, your hubbub this week?
Really, I'm kind of staggered by that one, I have to say. I was going to mention the ban of Four Loko, which is the caffeine alcohol drink, which I think may be a bit of a false issue, or at least a false sense of assurance. Of confidence that will come out of this ban, because kids have been binge drinking a lot is a serious problem on campus, and to suggest that by the mixing of caffeine and alcohol in this one particular drink is a unique problem is probably a little bit unrealistic.
And I did hear, I think it was maybe on BUR this morning, some local brewer saying she now has a problem because she puts a little bit of caffeine in her beer and suddenly her product is in jeopardy. So it looks like this might have some unintended ripple effects.
Yeah, and people can just drink a cup of coffee while having a beer, too.
I mean, it's the same effect.
Yeah.
So for my hubbub of the week, this actually might be a little news tip that you can run over and tell Boston.com, Peter Kanellis. But Paul LaCamera, who has been the general manager of WBUR for the past 5 years, announced today that he is going to be stepping down at the end of the year. And he might kill me for saying this, but Paul is going to be, I believe, 68 next year. And he just said it's time. He feels like it's time. And I think it was very emotional for him. And, you know, Paul is about as Boston a guy as you can get. He grew up in Winthrop. I'm pretty sure his mom still lives in Winthrop. He now lives in Boston. He's a proud Holy Cross alum. He has 3 master's degrees. He also went to BU and BC, so he's a proud alum of several local schools. Paul had led WCVB-TV, Channel 5. He had been there for about more than 30 years, including as its general manager. And, you know, when Paul came to WBUR, many people who've lived in Boston for a long time will remember that this was not a great time for the station. We had been in the news for reasons we didn't want to be in. You know, there were some financial and managerial issues. And Paul is the guy that really came back and put the station on firm footing, financially and otherwise. He's expanded programming. He's got us financially stable. One of the tributes to him today when he announced that he was leaving, he was called an astute businessman and a tireless advocate for the station, which is very true. This is a man who spends, I would say, most of his evenings and mornings at breakfasts, at events, at dinners, being an ambassador for the station, and he's leaving, and it's a huge loss for WBUR. And we'll find out, I think, in the next few weeks who the new leader will be, but it's a loss. So I want to mention that. And as I said, Peter, it's there's something for Boston.com if it's not on there already.
Yeah, I'll run right over there and tell them. I'm very sorry to hear that. He's a fine man.
He is. Thanks to both of you very much. Peter Kanellis is the editorial page editor for the Boston Globe, and Kurt Nikisch is the business and technology reporter for WBUR. Peter and Kurt, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And listeners, if you have any comments you want to make, you can add them at wbur.org/Boston.